We are not great. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. We're back. We're doing a new episode. We haven't talked about anything in a while, but our most recent episode was about the Maltese Falcon. We also previously talked about Boyhood, Dog Day Afternoon, Inside Man. You can find all these things on our website, themacguffinmen.com. We also reposted a couple older podcasts that were good about Drinking Buddies and the Silence of the Lambs. And I wrote a thing about Kendrick Lamar's new album, so you can read that on our website, themacguffinmen.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, at themacguffinmen. Yeah, we've got a couple new things in the works that hopefully will become available in the next month or so, so keep an eye out for that, at themacguffinmen. But yeah, we'll get to this episode.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
What are we talking about today?
We are talking about a most violent year.
Yes.
Just barely 2014's a most violent year.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's one of those, like... neither of us saw this in 2014. It was like New York and LA just to get in for Oscar season, sort of 2014.
Yeah, how'd that work out for them?
Not well, I don't think. They didn't get nominated for anything, right?
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you?
No, I think certainly not now, because I think there's going to be. I think I can see a time where, say, 10 years from now, we're J.C. Shandor making this movie and it not getting nominated for Oscars would be surprising. But now it doesn't seem surprising, you know?
Right. So J.C.
It's kind of like it's like The Place Beyond the Pines sort of thing. Like, I feel like if that director had Derek Cianfrance had more cred and he had been nominated for an Oscar for Blue Valentine, I believe, for screenplay, just like J.C. Shandor had been for Margin Call. But he wasn't like a big name as a director. I can see both of them making really well-liked movies by the Academy at some point in their career. They just don't have the clout to get the nominations yet.
Yeah, well, I don't want to talk about Place Beyond the Pines not getting any recognition because it's topic too near and dear to my heart. But this, I don't know, I was surprised by this. This seems like the kind of movie, but I understand what you're saying by them just not being on the radar enough. And so, yeah, as you mentioned, J.C. Shandor was the writer and director of this, and he directed Margin Call, and in between he did All Is Lost, which is a movie you enjoyed as well.
Yeah, yeah, I have liked all of his movies. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But yes, this was him writing and directing this one, and... How did you like?
I like this movie quite a bit. I think it's quite good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Yep. Yes, I think we feel the same way about this movie. This is one that you saw before me, and I hadn't watched, and I kind of asked your opinion about whether or not it was watching and doing an episode on, and I think you kind of tempered your excitement about it and told me to just watch it to not get my hopes up too high.
Well, I think I told you like immediately after I saw the movie, because you were kind of on the fence about seeing it at all. And I saw it when it was first released, the day it was released, just because I had the afternoon off, and just texted you and was like, yeah, it's worth it.
Okay.
Like, I don't, no matter what you think about this movie, I'm sure you wouldn't deny it was worth your 2 hours and 4 minutes, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I rewatched it, pretty quickly too, and enjoyed my second viewing of it even more. And I've only seen it twice, so maybe the third one it'll get even better. But I really wasn't sure what to make of it. I think a lot of people felt, just given the title, that it had to have more violence in it than it did. I don't think that's a real criticism, but I think that's kind of where this movie missed with some people, maybe. Because not only did it not get a lot of awards, or Academy Awards at least, it didn't make a lot of money.
No.
But that's not what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the actual content of this movie, because that's what we do here.
Before we move on, do you like the title of this movie? You care more about names and stuff than I do, so I'm curious.
Yeah, I do. I do like this one. I don't... It's kind of a unique title. I like movies that start... I like titles that start with the word A for some reason. And I do kind of like the idea that it it's not a violent movie and it has this title. And as kind of I'm sure we'll touch on later, this movie kind of has a distance from the violence. Like you do see the violence. It's not like it's all just off screen and implied, but the scenes that are violent are typically short and realistic and not directly occurring to our main characters most often. Mm-hmm. And I really like, you know, it seems like a gangster movie. Like it seems like he's supposed to be the head of the mob or something. Mm-hmm. And he's not. And I don't mean that the filmmaking, you know, led you astray or anything, but this just kind of has the feel and the structure of a lot of these kind of gangster movies, in mafia movies and crime boss movies and things like that. And, you know, it definitely shares a lot with that subgenre, but I really did like kind of that distance that this movie had from it and the very sparse and what I felt to be realistic violence.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I was just asking because I also really enjoyed the title of this movie. And that's, I don't know, names aren't really a thing I typically care about. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, let's get to that later. Let's start from the beginning here. Is very much Oscar Isaac's movie, I feel.
Oh, yeah.
And you liked him originally? You liked him, Llewyn Davis, right?
Yeah, Llewyn Davis is basically where I was just like leading the Oscar Isaac bandwagon after that movie. Mm-hmm. He's like, because I mean, he's in Drive, and I saw Drive and liked Drive, but I mean, you could have replaced him with pretty much anybody, and that movie wouldn't really change that much to me. But yeah, pretty much starting with Llewyn Davis, it's like, oh, this is a guy I would watch as a lead in pretty much any movie.
Yeah, and he has a very tempered, and a word I'm probably going to say about 40 times in this podcast, deliberate performance. Like, this very deliberate movie, everything about this, like the kind of craftsmanship about this movie, I consider to be very deliberate. There's three already. Mm-hmm.
And only 48 more to go.
Yeah. And like, I really liked it. And I think that there were kind of moments to get bigger. And I mean, he has kind of a few showy scenes, but this movie is kind of a lot quieter than I think it very easily could have been. And his performance is a lot quieter than it could have been. And I mean, both of those things in the best way possible.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like one of his biggest scenes starts with him just quietly saying stop. And it ends with him slightly louder saying stop. You
know? Yeah, exactly. And that, I mean, I think in the hands of, you know, I don't know who to give all the credit to, somewhere between J.C. Shander and Oscar Isaac. Yeah. That could have been a lot bigger. That could have been a kind of a chew the scenery scene and kind of a go-to big Oscar bait yelling scene. And it's just very, very tempered and very, I thought, very effective.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, so Oscar Isaac plays Abel Morales.
Yep. Abel Morales.
Right, sorry, Abel Morales. The reason I say Abel is...
because that's a name you've heard before?
Well, that and... No, this movie is about almost that name. It's about ability and morality, and I think that is so much of the things that are that define this main character. He is a very able person. He's a very capable person. We learn he's an immigrant who has started this business on his own, bought this business, but he runs it on his own. Fights very hard to avoid taking criminal shortcuts to expand his business or fight his competitors and things like that. And that comes through his morality. He's just seems to be a good person. You don't really see him disrespect anybody in this movie, let alone do anything horrific or violent to anybody.
Yeah.
And so I just thought that, you know.
I mean,
just...
he pistol whips a dude. That happens, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, okay. That's a bit provoked, I feel.
Yeah. Oh, it's certainly provoked, but it's not. Yeah. It's not, but like his hands never get dirty.
Yes, I did say he did do nothing violent, so you're right. Yeah. But yeah, I just
it was the most violent 10 seconds.
Yes, but I just feel there's a lot kind of, you know, packed into that name, and it's never really harped on. It's not as though they extrapolate that in the film. And I thought that was, you know, as you touched on my love of words and titles, I thought that was a nice little touch.
Yep, for sure.
And that really is kind of the struggle of this movie, is his attempt to maintain that credibility and maintain his morality despite getting pressure from all sides to do something that seems to simplify it for him.
Yes.
Or they claim is going to simplify it for him. But as we've seen from a lot of those gangster movies, taking that shortcut rarely simplifies things and certainly never stops violence permanently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that shortcut in those other gangster movies happens in the first act and gives you the second and third act. You know?
Yeah, where they die.
Or at least Sonny does. And in the movie, I mean, he's surrounded by people. Not even that suggest he take other ways, but just the people that are in his same business, that are all sitting around that round table having dinner before he arrives. There are just all these other people doing exactly what he does, but it seems like they are willing to do the things that he won't. And he very much doesn't want to be a part of that. And that is the whole struggle of the movie, is him trying to keep himself separate from the rest of the group. You know?
Right. But
both in success and actual methods.
Yeah, definitely. But even beyond that, I mean, he gets the pressure from Albert Brooks. Let's call him that.
Yep. I'm fine with it.
Okay. And then he's got pressure from the head of the Teamsters to arm his guys. And I mean, these aren't all people who are his competitors obviously are trying to outdo him. He feels pressure because they are, you know, trying to kick him out of the industry basically through violence and competition. But Albert Brooks, you know, he's on his team, you know, he works for him. He's someone who thinks that this needs to be, you know, these violent measures, or at least arming the drivers, is something that needs to be done for their business, to help their business. And he says he doesn't want to go that way. Again, the head of the Teamsters also wants to arm them. And he's not necessarily on the same side, but, you know, it seems to be a friend, kind of a business partner, not just trying to outdo him or run him out of the business, trying to get him to protect his own business and protect his drivers.
Yeah. And he's even like paired with Abel in their conversation when he says it's not like it was when you and I were driving, you know, like they used to be much closer, it seems like.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, and whenever we kind of get that that comparison, that kind of coupling, that's just to show how different they are. You know, when we say when we hear that they had, you know, a similar background, that's always to kind of juxtapose those two people's lives now. And we have this Teamsters guy who he wants to arm the drivers, but he's going to do it with these fake permits, you know, take all these legal shortcuts, you know, and it seems that the Teamster's heart is in the right place. You know, he wants his employees to be safe, but it's just not the way that, and obviously Abel's getting a ton of pressure from his wife to do things differently. And later we learn she has been doing things differently behind his back. So, yeah, there is that pressure. And I wanted to say, when you talked about his competitors, I really loved that it was kind of up in the air about whether or not they really were doing things illegally for a bit. You know, like maybe it is just these independent hijackers who are doing this, but obviously they need to sell it to someone. And so there is, like, we're kind of in a Bell's position where it seems pretty clear that someone is out to get him, but we just don't have the proof. We don't ever see that scene where one of his competitors is hiring someone or even just buying fuel from him. So I really liked our positioning with a Bell at that point in the story. I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. That scene you discussed of him coming to the that dinner. Him telling people to stop, the barbershop scenes with his competitors at the barbershop that apparently is only for oil executives in New York.
Jimmy O's Barbershop. I don't know if you got the name.
Yeah, I did.
The O is for oil. did you notice the first scene in the barbershop when spaghetti face man from True Detective says...
that is him.
Yeah. Oh, it is? Like, he's like, oh, really, Oscar Isaac? Like, when they start to get into it. Jimmy's reaction when he says that is so funny. It's like him just being like, oh, God, not again. Like, he visibly is kind of rolling his eyes. It's so funny.
As though, like, My guess is that business model for that barbershop is they pay like $1,000 a haircut, yeah. and they're the only clients. And anytime they get to kind of one of these like war of words, that the guy just kind of takes a break because, yeah, like he rolls his eyes and just kind of steps away and is like, yeah. all right, have your little pissing contest and then I'll finish cutting your hair.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, that was wonderful. And, you know, just the initial barbershop scene when he. Abel says, you know, any new areas. Well, what's that quote? When any new industries are a tough one. You know what I mean? That line.
I recall the scene. I do not recall the specific line.
Oh yeah, he says something about like, oh, I just saw your truck, one of your trucks in a certain area.
Oh yes, in Rockaway.
Yeah, and he says, you know, any new area is a tough one to get into, or something like that. And it's yeah. just about that's just another one of those things where he's kind of. It's an indirect threat. He's feeling pressure from other people. And it's, you know, they're kind of saying like, if this is really what you want to do, like if you want to break into new industry, this industry, and if you want to start taking our customers and getting into our territory, there's kind of this implicit, like you're going to have to get your hands dirty. Like this is just the industry we run. If you want to, play with the big dogs, like you're going to have to, you know, run your business in a criminal fashion.
Yeah.
And I love that it's about something as unsexy as heating oil. Like, I really love that a lot, and that it's you never hear about anything else, you know, like them doing gambling or running a prostitution ring. Like, it's just the money involved in this business, and that's all it is to it. And, you know, there's I've mentioned it before, but I think there's a ton of moments, not just in the acting is what I was discussing before, but there's a lot of ways that this movie could have just made it taken one of those cheap routes to make it more exciting or make it more glamorous. And it wasn't that. And I think that's what makes it a slow burn. And I think that's what maybe a lot of people didn't like about it. And what I think did get a bunch of critics who did like it, like it was received well critically, just not by the Academy.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's a million times more important.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like my opinions on the Academy are well documented.
Yes, absolutely. So go listen to all those ones.
Yeah, go listen to all previous 208 episodes or whatever.
Yeah. Oh God. Did you enjoy the that we open on him running?
Yeah, here's the thing, like I'm a sucker for a running metaphor. It's one of the few like overused metaphors that I'm just always on board with. I like the fact that we hear him kind of panting.
Why?
Before we see, because he's just it's just like before you even get into the movie, you know, this guy is trying hard. Before you know anything about him, he is physically exhausted by what he is doing. And
it keeps going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the song he's listening to. Happens to be my favorite Marvin Gaye song. So like right off the bat, we're in a good place for me, you know? And yeah, I enjoy that scene. I like the way pretty much the whole, opening credits go with that and juxtaposed with Julian being hijacked for the first time. I think that whole sequence is very, very good. And I think running in this movie is generally used well, even outside of just the scenes where we see Abel running. I think it's used well in ways that, you know, say something like 6 Feet Under, which had frequent running scenes, didn't necessarily, you know. It's like you said about the gangster movie, it has so many ways it could have just been over the top and things that other movies like this would do, and it just doesn't go the whole way where it would become annoying, you know. You know what I mean?
Definitely. Yeah. But what's the importance of running in this, other than him like being a hard worker?
Well, it comes with the pairing of Julian and Abel, right? Because throughout the movie, it's not subtle the way that the movie tries to kind of want us to see Julian and Abel as kind of starting from the same place and just sort of ending up in much different places, you know?
And not all through luck or
yeah,
circumstance.
Exactly. And they're the two characters we see running the most frequently. And the thing that's interesting about when they do run, when Julian runs the second time he's getting hijacked, when he has the gun and he eventually has to run from the cops, he's framed in the same way we will eventually see Abel framed with the camera in front of him. He's in the center of the frame and he's running towards the camera. And Abel does the same thing as he's chasing the guy that robbed him. But the difference is Julian is running away from the cops, whereas Abel is running towards the guy.
Chasing,
Yeah, exactly. And there's that line the last time that I think it's the last time that Abel and Julian talk, or it's the time where Julian doesn't turn himself into the cops. It's you're looking backwards, Abel says. Look forward. That's the only way you can control. And that's kind of what is happening. Like, Julian seems to always be running from something, and Abel is always running towards something. You know? Yeah. And we also get Abel sort of paired with the sound of a subway train as well. And it's sort of like he's just the more formidable runner, I suppose.
Yeah, the unstoppable one. Well, I think it's... I mean, by that same token, I think it's important that Julian is a good runner, just in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's very fast. He outruns those hijackers. I mean, like, when he chooses to, he's clearly faster than them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, he has the speed. Just instead of running towards the solution, he runs towards the problem. Yeah. Yeah, it's I had never actually even paired it with that quote you just listed. But yeah, that definitely kind of backs up that idea.
Yeah. One part of that scene where the hijackers and Julian are both running away from the cops. I love that scene, the way that once they get into whatever that
stairwell.
Yeah, the stairwell is, how they're just immediately like, well, we're in the same place now. He's like, there's a park down there, the exit, just go that way. And it's just like, I mean, there's still, you know, grudges there, but it's still just, you know, once it's clear he's not going to be able to rob this person of this truck, of his oil, he's just like, well, you might as well be able to get out of this. Here's the door. This is the best possible way for you, you know?
Yeah, and it's, I think it's like I was talking about before, like, it's just... the way that the other competitors speak to Abel, it's like, this is our industry. This is how we do things. Like, you're part of the game now, in the same way that, you know, once we're away from the cops, like, yeah, go get another truck and I'll hijack you another time. And like, this is just going to keep going like this because this is how this business works and you're a part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I love the running a lot. You know, they use it a few times and, the chase scenes are just phenomenal in this movie. I mean, we've talked about some good foot chase scenes in Brick. And what was the other one? I thought there was another one that we compared to Brick after we did Brick, too. Ooh, I don't know.
I don't know. They're probably. Yeah. but Brick
is the number
top
one.
Top of the pops, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, but I mean, the when Abel, you know, chases down his truck after it's been hijacked, you know, it starts as a car chase and then breaks into a foot chase and kind of a subway foot chase, and then that kind of short fight sequence with the 10 seconds of pistol whipping, as you had discussed. That sequence is fantastic.
Like, that sequence is very good. Yes.
Yeah, that's a really, really strong sequence there. That's the part where they show him, like, the camera's moving at a constant speed, and then Abel falls down on the and then has to catch up with the camera.
Yes.
It's just kind of, it keeps the shot on him, doesn't like cut to that one of him on the ground, which often happens when someone falls in a chase scene. Mm-hmm. I thought they just like, they kept that, and then Abel just had to catch up, and that's what Abel's life is. Like, he runs and he runs, and if he trips, he runs a bit faster to get to where he wanted to be. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah. I still haven't been able to find an answer, for whether or not that was intentional. I would be very curious to know the answer.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I just assumed it was, but yeah.
I could see it going either way. And the way the camera stops, I could see it having been both planned or not. But the fall looks so much like a fall.
And it's and because you don't get that cut, you know it's the real actor, you know? Yeah. Like, we don't get that kind of one where like, okay, we'll kind of stumble and then we're going to insert a shot of you on the ground. Like, and I love that focus. And I love, it speaks so much about the way Abel is. Like, he's just so focused and so single-minded and so goal-oriented. Like, the camera doesn't cut away from him just because things are going bad. Like, it's, I think that's Abel's eyes just constantly looking and constantly looking straight ahead at whatever it is he wants. And, like, I mean, there's many shots of this movie and kind of many way a lot of these scenes play out, but, you know, make eye contact for longer than is comfortable. Like, yeah, you know, that's that. A scene. And I love that scene too, that whole speech too. But that's something that's pervasive throughout this movie. It's this idea of like staying on something longer than you should stay. Mm-hmm. Comfortable, staying on something longer than everybody else is doing, because that's how you get to that thing.
Yep, absolutely. You'll never do something as hard as staring somebody straight in the eye. The truth. I love that line.
Oh, I know. There's so much about that. Like him as the businessman, like him dealing with his employees and coworkers and stuff. I thought there's so much good stuff in there.
Oh yeah.
But I want to talk about the car chase scene even before that kind of running sequence. That's so much of this movie to me, because I think it's really important to point out that he's chasing his own truck. Like it's his business. It's his goal. Like I love that he's just running down this idea of like his big expanding business. It's his own truck. And then throughout that sequence, you know, he just blows through stop signs without looking, you know, he's just so focused on what it is he wants. Mm-hmm. This business of his, that he blows through the stop signs. The truck takes that turn into like a tunnel that's mm-hmm. so dark, and he just goes right, like, just follows it right there. Doesn't even think about it. And he's just so blindly chasing his goal. And, you know, he's literally going for the light at the end of the tunnel at that point. Like, he's just following it and just chasing his goals down. And that's just so much of what a bell is through this whole movie.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
Yeah. That's, and I mean, that's a long sequence there, too, that I think, like, you don't need to pepper that many of those throughout a movie for it to be good. And I think it makes that one time that you do, like, make a long sequence like that so powerful.
Yeah, I agree.
And the time Julian is hijacked the first time, that's a really short scene. Like, that is not a, the actual violent part of that scene, I mean, it's not long. Like,
well, I mean, though, from start to finish, it's no more than a minute, even with cuts back to a bell.
With a bell, yeah. And I mean, that's kind of one of those things, like I was saying, that I liked. Like, they don't lean on the violence too hard. They have the kind of necessary violence. And it still hospitalizes Julian, because he gets, you know, pistol whipped in the face a bunch, and then gets pushed out of a tall truck onto the ground, and he's like almost unconscious, so he can't break his fall. Mm-hmm. And you know, you see him in the hospital, just how damaged he is. He can barely talk, and he's off work for a while. And I just thought that was really realistic, and still kind of kept that distance between Abel and the violence physically, but mm-hmm. showed all the implications and how much this messed things up. And then, you know, the Teamsters want them to have guns, and then the bank backs out of that land deal, which we haven't really mentioned, but is a pretty central part of the narrative of this movie. Mm-hmm. I thought that was just great.
Yep.
Did you get any French Connection vibes during the foot chase?
Yeah, I guess it's there.
Yeah, the one part that was really to me was they kind of linger on a shot where no one's running, but you just get the elevated subway car going over the street. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of already thinking French Connection, and then like there's no one really in frame, and then the train, the subway train comes in, and in French Connection, they're very famously chasing the subway train with the car, and I like that a lot.
Okay, yep.
What else you got about this movie?
I don't know. Like it. I mean, there's obviously the speech at the end, like the very last scene. That's very wonderful.
I have a ton more to say. I just feel like I was talking a lot. Make sure if you had any points you wanted to bring.
I love a handful of moments in this movie. One of them is that we haven't actually mentioned, but we've kind of talked about how the movie accentuates this point more, but without discussing this specific scene. But the scene where character Albert Brooks asks Abel, why do you want this so badly?
Oh, yes.
And Abel just blankly responds, I have no idea what you mean. Like, I love that line so much.
It's so, like, his ambition is like so deeply embedded into him, like he can't even recognize it for what it is. And I think I misspoke kind of earlier about him kind of blindly following goals. Like, this isn't a story about hubris. This isn't about someone wanting to get too big and doing everything it takes. You know what I mean? Like, it's about him having this pretty noble goal of just starting a bit, like expanding his business and, you know, not being a criminal in doing so.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we don't see a ton of his family life, but it seems healthy and normal and happy. And, you know, we don't see him like cheating on his wife or blowing a bunch of money on something at the expense of the business, you know, mm-hmm. like he's just this good, ambitious guy. And I think that scene. Oh, perfectly. And I assume you noticed this if I noticed it, but there is the slowest zoom happening in that scene as we get like closer and closer to a bell. And he's just like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, and he's not just being coy or playing dumb. Like, he's honestly clueless as to why everyone doesn't think this way.
Yeah. Yeah, that is a great scene. But you mentioned one of the things I hate about this movie. That slow push in that you mentioned.
Yeah.
That's happening constantly in the movie. Okay. There's so frequently just the slightest camera move going on. And it starts right off the bat, like the first when we see Julian lying on the ground right before the title card, we're getting the slowest push out away from him. But the point that you're making, like if there was an idea behind it, it's that. It's like we're getting closer into this world or closer to this goal or further away from this world or further away from this goal. But every time it happens, it feels to me like it's something instead of nothing.
Okay.
Like just they wanted a camera move and we're just like, well, we just got to have a move. You know, we got to have this slow push in or slow push out. And it happens all throughout the movie. And it's so these movements are so small that doesn't fucking matter that they're there, so why are they there, you know? And I just, if even if it is justified by that whole you know, we're creeping in on our goal like a bell is, it's still not, it's not enough for me. It's not, I still don't like the idea, you know.
I think I didn't really notice it often, and
it's
think
constant by the 20 minute mark of this movie I was like, okay, JC, cool it.
Well, that's what I was saying. If I noticed it, you must have. Yeah. I think if it was used more sparingly, which in my viewing it was because I didn't see all of them, I think it's effective. But I'm not going to try to make that excuse, you know, for the filmmaker. If like, I thought I noticed it, it did fit in thematically. But yeah, if that's happening constantly, then maybe it is just for the sake of wanting to do something visually.
Yeah, I also hate the color correction in this movie a lot.
Okay, let's talk about that.
It's just, I hate when, and I mentioned to you off the podcast, I saw this in Selma back to back, both shot by Bradford Young, the cinematographer, and both of them were like well praised for their cinematography, and both of them rely on the shittiest sepia Instagram filter throughout the whole movie. And I hate it when movies about a period feel this weird, weird like obligation to make them look kind of older, and digital cinematography just will never be able to look really old fashioned because it's not a technique that is old fashioned. And I just hate it when they try. I mean, we probably talked about this when Public Enemies came out, but one of the things I loved about the way Michael Mann shot that movie was that he shot it exactly the same way he shot Collateral. He just shot it like he was making a movie in 2009 because that's what he was doing, you know? And yeah. He was shooting it digitally, and there was no way to really make it look old-timey without it being hacky. And the old-timiness of A Most Violent Year is extremely hacky to me.
Okay. Yeah, I heard some people complaining about the orange and teal thing that is kind of pervasive in filmmaking outside of this movie as well.
Yeah. Oh man, color correction right now is in a bad, bad place. as much as I love the Coen brothers, they are a trailblazer of something I hate, which is the color correction in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Oh my God. Okay. That was the first feature-length film to be entirely digitally color-corrected. And
right.
The Cobros and Freaky Deaky, they did filmmaking a disservice with that one.
Right. Did you notice any difference between like visually between the interior and exterior shots?
I mean, aside from darkness.
The indoor is dark, right?
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is it always that way?
No, but I mean, there is a very sort of there is a feeling of darkness throughout this movie, this sort of pervasive people being in the shadows, you know.
Yeah, I thought outside was like kind of bright and crisp, like mm-hmm. the outdoor scene, and then the inside was like the more the dark brooding thing.
Yeah, I mean it is sunny in this movie more often than you would expect a movie of this tone
with,
to be.
With that poster.
Yeah. which is like 60% negative space. I think it is sunny more often than you would expect, but yeah, I don't know. Do you have a point on that?
Not really. I mean, yeah. I sometimes leave open-ended visual questions for you because yeah. you're better at them. But no, I mean, we talked about in Memento, like, I think dealing with something so dark and giving it that to make it so bright, and, you know, that was kind of budgetary, I understand. Yeah. But I think, to use this word for the fifth time, I think the juxtaposition is pretty nice. When
the deliberate juxtaposition
is very nice when that happens.
Yeah. I think you touched on this with Memento. I don't remember what the budget for Most Violent Year is, but I know it's not high. And I think they probably shot this in the summer, or at least towards the end of the winter. And a lot of it was just sort of budgetary, you know, just sort of like, well, that's the weather today. This is what we're shooting in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. New York, 1982, I guess. Could be snowy. New York's a cold place. So.
I've got 1981 in New York City, 1981.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. You're right. We even almost corrected this before the podcast.
We were so close, James.
And it's in every trailer, isn't it?
What's yeah, that that's what I thought I remembered. And that's why I was arguing with you.
Yeah, but on that point and on that line that was used in all the advertising of this movie,
the budget of this movie is $20 million, by the way.
Yeah, I know that. Mm-hmm. And the line that they used in a lot of the advertising for this movie was the when they say, you know, there's been more rapes and murders in the city than there this year than there has been any other year.
Yeah,
and I thought we were going to be in for like a this city's going to shit kind of movie with mm-hmm. a lot of like. You know, you run into hookers and there's like news reports about all this violence and that's not related to him. Mm-hmm. Like kind of just this tangential stuff. And that I didn't find that to be the case at all. Like this movie was just very focused on Abel and that industry. And historically, it had a lot of ammo for why it could be a movie like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, as I said, this is just kind of like a crafted movie about a very particular person and a very particular topic. And that was just one of those other things that I like, that they just used some restraint. Like,
yeah.
It was just one other thing that they could have made this a bit more violent, a bit sexier, a bit more like other violent gangster movies. And they avoided it. And I thought that was just a great control by the filmmaker.
Yeah, well, and I think that's part of the idea of the movie is that because, yeah, like you mentioned, New York at this time is a notoriously terrible place to be.
Yeah, like factually. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And I think what's interesting about that and the way that this movie starts at the beginning of the 80s and what you talked about with it kind of or what we discussed a bit with them kind of being in the shadows a lot inside is that it's kind of like Abel wants to avoid this crime. He wants to avoid the things that are happening in the city around him in the time that this movie is taking place. And as New York becomes, you know, gets more and more cleaned up by the end of the 80s and going into the Giuliani years. What's really just happening is that there's not this physical violence, but these people that are running the companies are still being terrible people, just in less conspicuous ways, basically.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I find really interesting. And I think that's kind of plays into the whole, there's a lot of talk of fathers in this movie. A lot of talk of, a visual cue of the very traditional Jewish people that that Abel is buying the property from. And there's a lot of talk of like the old world laying the groundwork for where we are today. And the 80s is kind of like a notoriously, money centered decade, you know, you get Reagan becomes the president and all that. And we go into the 90s, which becomes a very good, time for the economy. And basically what I think this movie is trying to tell us is that, yeah, Bell's not a violent person, but that doesn't mean he's not a terrible person. And that doesn't mean that the person that Abel laid the groundwork for is a good person either. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of hadn't thought of that, but it was, maybe it's, you know, those awful people in the '80s just are now powerful enough that you can't do anything about, like,
exactly
the white collar crimes they commit. And I mean, Gordon Gekko, all that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I did enjoy that this, like on that note, I did find this kind of be one of the of a person trying to avoid a life of crime. Like, that is another thing that's big in gangster movies. I like, but it, often that part of the movie doesn't ring true for me in mm-hmm. that subgenre. Like, there's always that part where they say, oh, we're forced into it, and you know, the, things like that. But then they're enjoying the high life and like enjoying being feared or respected by everyone and like spending all this money. And we just don't see that from Abel. Like, that's something that like his reluctance to be violent, his reluctance to turn his organization into a criminal one, I feel was one of the most genuine examples of that I've like seen in a movie. And I think like, and because that is so central to the character and that trait of this character is so central to the movie, I thought like that was something that really made it effective for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah. Let's talk about Abel's coat.
Okay.
Actually, you know what? No. we'll save that. No, we're still going to talk about that.
Oh, okay. Just not yet. All right.
Let's talk about his family life and his wife for a bit, because it's, I think we've said wife once, and she is kind of one of the lead characters of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
How criminal is she? How criminal is Abel? Like, how much does he know that his, and how dirty is his business at all?
I mean, his business certainly seems to be dirty in some way that if somebody were to look closely enough could be deciphered. That's kind of what I take away from that bank account at the end, is that even though Abel didn't notice, if somebody had looked hard enough, I feel like there could be criminal implications.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. But what I mean is that that bank account, which he very clearly didn't know about, mm-hmm. which ends up saving him. He doesn't know about that. But when he hears about the cops looking at him, he's worried in a way that he knows something. You know, he's not just confused by it. He has his wife look over the books right away in a way that says like, oh, they must be wrong. But like, no, you have to hide whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Like, he seems to be aware of something that's never spoken. And I get the vibe that he knows something isn't right, you know?
Yeah, I think because I do think there are certainly a lot of allusions to the way that Anna, that's her name, right?
Jessica Chastain is the name you're looking for. Albert Brooks, Jessica Chastain. Yeah.
Okay.
His wife.
No, it is Anna. Fuck, what were we talking about? I lost it.
You lost it while you're looking at the Wikipedia page.
Yeah, 100%.
About her kind of role in how criminal this business was and
Abel's
level of knowledge.
Yeah, they talk about the way that this business, or the way that her father and her brother would kind of react to such things. Like early on when they're in the hospital and with Julian and Abel and Jessica Chastain / Anna go outside into the hall to one talk about how the deal went, and then also she says, do you want me to call my father or my brother, do you want me to call my father, and Abel says, leave your father and brother out of this. Like, it's just very clear that he doesn't like the way that his father ran the business before he bought it. And I think that's where his fear comes out of, and his assumption that there is probably something wrong, because and just the way he always talks about Anna's father in this movie, it just seems, even though we never see him, it seems very strongly like there's people that have differences in the way that they like to approach life. And I would imagine that the movie wants us to think that Anna's father approached business in the exact opposite way that Abel does.
Oh, I thought it was pretty clearly stated that he was a mobster. Yeah. Don't they call her like a mobster's daughter at some point?
Probably.
I think that's happened. Yeah. But that's what still strikes me is that when he immediately asked how far back are they going to go? And they say, as soon as you bought the business. Mm-hmm. So it seems, and he's still worried. So it seems like maybe something, even while it was entirely under his control, was still pretty shady. And maybe that's just, you know, there's some leftover residuals or there's someone that's still on the payroll you know, like a fixer or something pretty dicey. But
and there's also, I feel like anytime somebody's under investigation by the district attorney, I feel like there is just some fear that you're allowed to have, you know?
No.
Like, if I get audited this year, I know my taxes are fine, but I'm still going to be afraid, you know?
No, I know, but I think I said that when I, like, initially, like, he seems worried beyond the amount that you should be worried anytime you're being indicted or whatever.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think it's clear that he...
And they are actually trying to hide things, you know? Like, we see them try to hide these boxes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, do you want to talk about that scene?
I think that is another expertly directed scene. We talked about the chase and the intro. I think the third really good example is that scene. It's just, there's something about the way the music and Anna and the DA's conversation and that shot of Abel that's a push in that I like, a dolly into a bell where he's sitting on the boxes. And also when he's framed from behind, that's a nice shot too. But just that whole sequence is really nice. And he's not sure what he's afraid of, but he feels like there's something to be afraid of.
I did. That scene doesn't really stand out. The whole thing didn't stand out to me as much as it did to you, I guess. But there's just like, there's a couple visual things in there that I thought I was able to read into, like, just a sequence of cops walking through the same doorway that children are exiting a birthday party.
That's a great moment. Yeah, I didn't mention that either. That's great.
Yeah, and like, again, I don't think they lean on it too hard, and like, you know, they just kind of let it go, and Anna's being very friendly. And
I love the one mom that doesn't take the loot bag too. Like, and it's not like most people are just like, well, I guess we take the loot bag. And then the one mom's like, no, this is weird. I'm not into this. I don't support it. I don't know. It was good that not everybody left angry, but that there was still one person that did. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's, I think, would be part of Abel's fear, is that people start seeing him this way and people don't take the loot bags from his parties anymore. But no, like, they see they
should have put the files in the loot
bag. No, but just that, like, people's opinions change, not even when you're declared a criminal, but when police are around, police are looking into your business, like, it has that vibe. And I think that's exactly what he's worried about. And, you know, as you said, that I like that's the shot of him under the house, like, he's kind of like relegated below this domestic life that he wants, you know, just because he's involved in this business that isn't completely tidy. He's like stuck, like, he's relegated beneath his family life. And there's just a little beat in, you know, there's a couple, like, there's a ton of these in this movie, like, just letting something breathe a little bit longer, as we talked about. There's just him, like, just sitting on those boxes for a second, and he's not, like, head in his hands, like, crying or freaking out. It's just like, he's thinking about something. Like, there's just one more thing, and, like, this isn't right. What's happening? What could they find? And he's just sitting, like, you know, he's literally on top of what could be incriminating evidence, and literally below his family. Without harping on the visual metaphors too hard, I thought that was a good one.
Yeah. And that we got that nice little exclamation mark at the end of the scene where Jessica Chastain says, "And you're not going to find a fucking thing." I'm not the biggest fan of Jessica Chastain in this movie, but when she gets to be kind of more authoritative, I think she's really great in this movie. And that's a good moment.
Yeah, their relationship's a little weird. Between her and the DA or assistant DA, whatever he is.
Well, that's pretty much the only time they speak to each other, isn't it?
I thought there was one more.
There might be. You might be right.
Yeah.
There's always the possibility that they're hiding something in the business, and there's always the possibility that you might be right.
The slight possibility that you may be correct about this movie you watched.
I will never admit it, but it might exist.
Floating in the ether there. I mean, we should talk about we did touch on it a bit, but just that that business deal that is really central to this movie. Mm-hmm. he just wants to get to the water. And, you know, water is often in film kind of a, you know, purifying, regenerating metaphor. Like, if maybe if he can get to the water, he can like cleanse this business and cleanse his soul of anything he's done in the meantime. And it's also just, as he said, like he just wants to be able to bring his own oil in without having to pay, which is very, I got a big There'll Be Blood vibe from that.
Oh, yeah, there's There'll Be Blood vibes all throughout this movie.
Yeah, yeah, he just, like, he wants to just be able to control his own fate, which is so much of what Abel's about. What else was there for There'll Be Blood?
The title. I think that's a big one.
It's four words long.
No, a most violent year. It's not particularly violent. There will be blood. It's not particularly bloody. And that was kind of a talking point of There Will Be Blood when it came out. It's this one guy focused on a very specific goal and kind of not focusing too much on anything else around it. It's just a very pointed movie. Yeah,
that's true. And it, like an ominous title. And as we said, like, maybe even if there's not that much violence and like on screen, it's clear that this whole industry is corrupt and that there might be, you know, some of the more kind of implicit violence, like the corruption and things like that, that we kind of get a bit of a taste of in this movie.
Yeah, and it's all about kind of like I mentioned, forefathers. It's like Daniel Plainview is kind of a forefather, as is you know, laying the groundwork for business people like Abel, who is laying the groundwork for people, business people like people that run businesses today, like the people that were the villains in Margin Call, you know.
Yeah. What other movies are in here?
There's a lot of Godfather.
Right. Oh, he looks so much like Pacino on the poster, the cover too.
Yeah. The lighting inside, the very yellow Gordon Willis-y lighting. Travis and I talked a lot about James Gray's movies earlier this year, and a lot of his movies Travis likes to describe as baby's first Godfather movie, and which one is really funny. He also used that to describe The Voice Beyond the Pines. Yeah, The Most Violent Year could also be described as baby's first Godfather movie. Yeah, like there's just that immigrant story and building a business, may or may not be criminals involved, and yeah, there's a little, and like you mentioned, there's a touch of French Connection, and there was a lot of I remember coming out of this movie thinking, oh, that kind of felt like a Sidney Lumet movie a little bit, and then thinking about J.C. Chandor's career and how none of his movies are the same, but you can always see like he doesn't really have, he's just not David Fincher, he doesn't have that kind of defined style, but you can always feel like you always kind of know you're watching a J.C. Chandor movie, even though it's really subtle. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of the Sidney Lumet thing. It's just a very precise, very skilled craftsman who tackles these different stories in whatever way best fits them. And I go and get a sandwich in between movies and read the National Post review of this movie, and like Sidney Lumet's mentioned in the first paragraph. I'm just like, yep, I guess that's a thing people are talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I think it had like, in general, I thought it was kind of like a 70s vibe, and I'm not the first person to pick that up. I know that's not.
I mean, it takes place barely after the
70s. Yeah, but just kind of the slow burn and a lot of those things we were talking about, just kind of being more restrained about the violence and about not necessarily plugging in some sexy things just to me. And I don't mean sexy as in sexual always, but just kind of easy things to grasp just to make it that much more exciting. I think there's so much in this movie that is effective without having to rely on that.
Yeah. It's sort of equal parts. There are some things I find really interesting and modern about this movie. And then a lot of, like you said, a lot of 70s. Like there's a lot of sort of what I would say are shards in this movie, like really tiny bits of plot, like what you said with the new workers at Standard Oil. They have so little, but they kind of make an impression on you. Same with, like, they don't do a lot, but they make a pretty big impression, and you remember that they exist. Julian probably has 10 minutes of screen time, but he feels like he has a much bigger part in the movie. Alessandro Nivola's character, the tennis playing competitor, Peter Garrity as the Teamsters guy, like all of these people that have just very small scenes that kind of really end up having a, like, really making an impression on you with almost no screen time.
Yeah.
And it's hard to describe. And It's a combination, I think, of performance and actually the script being good. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like that's kind of modern, like how movies feel kind of an obligation to be more like, or good movies like this feel an obligation to be more like an HBO show. And I think this movie gets a lot of so many characters into 2 hours that we just don't even think about because we're so focused on Abel, but we can still remember them all when we sit back and think about the movie, you know?
Yeah. And speaking of HBO, I think it leaves you with the wire in your mouth, like the taste of the wire, like the ending when he's kind of reached a point where he's powerful enough that his crimes don't matter to the DA anymore. And now it's just like, okay, let's just do each other favors. Like, and that leads to that, obviously just encourages more crime and corruption and things like that. And I didn't feel that throughout the movie until the very end. Like that seemed like a very season two wire kind of thing for me. And obviously I never mean that in a bad way. And one last other comparison, I got a big Nightcrawler vibe out of this too. Like a man just kind of doing, like making his own business, working very hard to keep it a certain way, and plugging that tank of oil at the end, and then getting someone to call the police is, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal filming this dead body instead of doing anything to help, you know?
Yeah, I of course love the part where he plugs the oil, but like he plugs the wound that matters to him. The thing I really love about Oscar Isaac in that scene is when Julian shoots himself, we get a cut to Abel, and the fucking facial expression is just annoyance. Like he's annoyed, and he nails it. It's so good. It's such a good tidy moment where he doesn't get a lot. It's another one of those things where it's no Oscar-y. Like if Sean Penn is playing Abel, he goes, and then he wins. Is that my daughter in there? And then he wins 40 Oscars.
Is that
Oscars.
My oil? Is that my oil in there?
Yeah, exactly. The music fucking swells. And people are like, Boston's a terrible dark place. Anyway. And there's just none of that.
Listen to our Mystic River podcast if you want to hear us talk about Sean Penn like that some
more. You want more details on Mystic River. Or just basically that over and over for 45 minutes. I think that's a good scene to point to where it's very subtle. There's no large music swell or anything like that as Julian dies. Yeah. And we just get this moment of pure annoyance from Abel, and Oscar Isaac plays it perfectly. And there's a bunch of little things that Oscar Isaac does throughout the movie that I think are just really nice touches. Like when that scene where he's shaving and he says, we'll use the money from that bank account. It's the right play or whatever. As he's leaving, he just like touches Jessica Chastain on the leg, like in a very sort of, you know, like the way a husband would touch his wife, but something that nobody would think of, you know, like they had this fight and he's just like, yeah, just lightly touching her to be like, yeah, we're okay, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really great moment that is clearly not the focus of that scene, but it's just something that's there if you want to pay a lot of attention to Oscar Isaac, I guess.
Which you do.
He's a good actor.
Yeah. All right. Well, we teased it earlier, people.
We're here.
We're going to talk about Abel's coat.
Gotta give the people what they want, right?
Yeah. Did you have any read on it? Like, I think in our vague texts, we mentioned this coat because...
You mentioned it, and I hadn't seen the movie in a couple months. And I just was... My actual response was, does somebody wear a yellow coat in this movie? And I meant that. That wasn't a joke. I couldn't remember. Yeah.
I don't know. I find it so prominent. Like,
I think it looks like a much cheaper coat than it's probably supposed to look like.
Yeah,
it did. Like something about the fabric looks cheap, and I mean, I'm no fashionista, but
I read somewhere that it's camel hair, so maybe that's I don't know if that's cheap or gross or really nice.
It's definitely gross. Doesn't sound cheap though.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I even the first time through, like I really noticed it a lot. I felt like it. You know, it's this yellow, so obviously visually, it stands out a lot. Maybe not so much in the sepia tone of the rest of this movie.
It just looks like everything else in this movie.
No, but I thought it just stood out a lot. Like, and even when it wears it in the snow, or if he's wearing it in, like all the dark indoor scenes, like it's kind of bright. It's a really long coat as well, and so it takes up a lot of the frame when they kind of give you the whole shot of him. And so I was watching for it more closely the second time through, and like he's a lot more powerful in the scenes when he has his coat on, I noticed. And the ones where he's just wearing like his suit and things like that, he's not. And even like, and it's not even just indoor or outdoor, because there are scenes when he is inside and he's still wearing the coat. Like sometimes he's in a garage or like kind of a warehouse kind of thing that you can imagine would be colder. But
yeah, and like in that why do you want this so badly scene, they are kind of in, they're inside a structure, but he's still wearing the coat, like they're not in an office.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, and yeah. He really kind of owns all those moments, I find. And then and I mean, these all make sense why he would be weaker at these moments, but I think it was kind of something of a deliberate wardrobe choice, like when he goes to that other, his one of his competitors to try to buy the, or to borrow some money, and he ends up putting up some of his control of some of his business. He's like waiting outside their office, and he's just like looks like so weak without his coat. He's like,
well, and the coat is on the couch next to him.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's there, and he's just without it. Like it's just this thing. Like it gives him power, and he doesn't have it in this position that he's in right now. Like all the cards are, the ball's in someone else's court. You know.
Yep. No, that's a good point.
Yeah, and if you watch it, like I don't know, there's just, I thought there's just a couple.
We teased it earlier, but I'm gonna say it. You're right.
yeah, there's just a lot of those moments. Like you could kind of see where he wants to be, whether or not he's wearing it. And then that got me thinking about, you know, that coat and what it says. And it's like, it seems to be him kind of protecting himself from exterior forces, and not in like a shy or like a weak kind of way, but just the way that he kind of bolsters his defenses, and the way he is kind of a very powerful person with a lot of these pressures, a lot of these external forces working against him, but like he's got this surrounding, and he's got this thing that like kind of holds everything in and holds everything else out, and you know, it protects him, and it protects him from, you know, literally the snow, but thematically, metaphorically, protects him from kind of the pressures and the temptations that he's feeling to break the law, to get ahead, or to continue to expand.
Yeah, and I mean, we mentioned one 70s Gene Hackman movie earlier. Now it's time to mention a second. It's like The Conversation.
The Conversation, yeah.
Call's Call.
Yeah, and I mean, I mentioned snow there too. Like, there is a ton of snow in this movie, as we said earlier. It seems really present in this movie. And, you know, you said it was budgetary. I'm going to try to make a case that it was more of a choice than that that gives off. To me, the snow is like the corruption and violence that is around his life and is within this the oil industry. And it's just always there, like that pressure, that violence, that corruption is always present. And he runs through it, he runs over it, but you know, it's always the something that needs to be navigated and to move around or through, but to be dealt with, but only temporarily. Like every time he does something, he never really solves a problem. He just gets past one, and there's still another one there. And the snow is just always there. Like there's so many scenes, it's just on the ground or it's in the background. It's like that constant pressure he's feeling, and he never gets rid of it. And near the end of the movie, it's one of the few times where we kind of get like the camera's a lot higher and it's aimed down, and we can kind of
get the Fincher shots in the last.
Yeah, that's right. And we see the snow, and it's one of the few times where like that I could notice, at least, that the snow really has a lot of tire tracks in it. Mm-hmm. And like it's like he's made progress by this point. Like some of it's gone. Like you can see his steps that have been made over it, or his tire tracks. Like there is.
He's making it through winter.
Yeah, he's making it through. He's making his own way through it. He's not getting out of it, but like he's figuring out a way that his business can function in this insanely violent and corrupt industry. And by the end of the movie, like the movie does come to a conclusion, but it's not a perfect one. Like I don't mean that in a filmmaking point, but I just mean like his struggle is obviously not over. This movie is over, but he's there's still going to be more for him to deal with. And then we kind of get that final shot, and I think it kind of pulls away, zooms out, and then we see him, we see his car, his family car, we see his business fleet, like all his trucks, and then we see cop cars. And it's just kind of like, this is what it is. This is what the rest of his life's going to be. He's going to have his family in one spot. He's going to have his business in one spot, and he's going to have institutions in this one place. And at this point, like, he's kind of gone along with the DA saying, you know, we'll help each other. So, and And that's like, that seems to be where we leave a bell. Like, he's got this domestic thing, he's got this financial thing, but then he's also got this criminal thing that's always with him. And of course, there's still snow everywhere in that scene. It's kind of one of the widest shots, and it's so much ground, and it's just covered with snow. And it's just that that corruption and that violence is never, ever going to go away for him. Mm-hmm. That's all I got.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we didn't really talk about the conversation there, which I think is a really interesting conversation. I like that it's like the last thought of the movie vocally, you know, the one that leads with "I'm not a felon," and then the DA saying that's probably true. love that line too.
But irrelevant, right?
Pardon?
Like it's that might be true, but it's irrelevant.
Well, yeah, as we learn through the rest of that conversation as well, and that yeah. the DA is going to let a few things slide over the
yeah,
next few
yeah,
years.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And I really like Abel's last speech where he's talking about the path that is the most right. You know, like the result, actually, I wrote it down. The result has never been a question for me, just the path that you take to get there. And there is always one that is the most right. And that is what this is. And like what he's done is the most right way to do it. And he never comes off as like a terrible person, but I don't leave this movie feeling like Abel is a great person, you know?
No.
Mostly, and a big part of that happens to come in the like 3 minutes before where that facial expression I described, where one of his employees kills himself in front of him and Abel just looks annoyed. and it's like, I believe I mentioned this earlier, you can be a shitty person without physically doing shitty things, you know? Yeah. And, yeah, and I think that's interesting that, you know, he might be doing things in the way that is the most right, but he's still not a good person, you know? Like,
yeah,
it's just sort of this, there's just this inherent corruption within business, you know?
Yeah, and the most right implies some wrong.
Yeah.
he's the most right, but he's not good.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as a man starting a business, I see Abel as a real... real role model.
Yeah,
you said it was a camel hair coat that I need to get?
Yeah, I hope I don't have to take such violent steps in my improv group that I said. I hope that's not part of that business as well. Okay. I highly doubt it is.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for listening to the MacGuffin. be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about Furious 7 for sure, and I think Casablanca as well.
Yeah.
All right.
Equally good films.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I feel like Furious 7 is the first sequel to Casablanca in the Furious series. Anyway, so check back for that, and we'll talk to you then. All right. Later.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.